This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us, Charles Sauer, libertarian economist, president of the Market Institute, author of a forthcoming book, Profit Motive, What Drives the Things We Do. MarketInstitute.org is the website. And you can tweet him at Charles Sauer, S-A-U-E-R, or at Market Institute. Charles, welcome back to the program. It's been a while. Charles?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you now. There you go.
All right.
Welcome back. I wanted to ask you how libertarians deal with this issue of education. We have an educational system now that is all over the place. We've got free schools, free public schools. We've got subsidized charter schools. We've got paid private schools. We've got colleges that are in some places locally subsidized and free. We've got colleges that are just obscenely expensive. We've got for-profit education. And then on top of that, for the people who go to college, we've got some really expensive college debt, 6, 7, 8% loans in a time when banks can borrow money at 1.5%, which seems insane to me. Why are we doing this to our kids? My position as an American, not as a libertarian, would be that we should invest in our children. Our most important infrastructure is our intellectual infrastructure. As Jefferson repeatedly pointed out, without an educated populace, you can't even have a functioning democracy. And therefore, it is the job of all of us to make sure that everybody is educated to the peak of their potential at no cost to them. So all schools should be free, and we should do away with even the concept of student loans. How do libertarians approach this? And do you agree that, you know, with Jefferson and me, that, you know, having a well-educated populace is an essential element of a functioning society?
Well, see, I agreed with you right until your conclusion, right? So you are correct. Education is unbelievably important. There's a book by one of my friends out called Hive Mind that actually proves that as education of a society increases, so does the GDP of those communities. But right. The fact is that where we differ is how you actually create that. So, I mean, you support the teachers unions, and the profit motive behind the teachers unions doesn't have anything to do with education, and rightfully so.
The teachers union is a nonprofit democratic institution. There is no profit associated with the teachers union.
That is completely false. There is profit all throughout that. They take the money from the teachers, and then they spend it on salaries from person to person to person. That's actually in.
That's not profit,
nobody,
Charles. Profit
that
is the money.
Profit.
Hey, no, Econ 101. Profit is the money that's left over after your operations. And nonprofit organizations, they call it a fund balance, but they can't distribute it to the owners. You're talking about salaries and wages, not profits.
No, I'm talking about benefit. I'm talking about the actual definition of profit, though, not the politicized one. If you want to politicize education, you can. I believe that we should provide a strong education to our students, and that means setting the market free. Not having a mass of taxpayers pay for individual students where the parents of the students no longer have a say. It's like buying a Snickers bar and having somebody else eat it. You don't know what the product does. If you buy a Snickers bar and eat it and it's bad, then you can move on. But the way that the left supports the education system is by saying it doesn't matter. We want the teachers to have all of the power and the parents and the students to not have any of it.
No, nobody's saying that at all. That's a straw man argument, number one. And number two, the broad availability of Snickers bars is not essential to democracy. I'm talking about this is an appropriate definition of the commons. I mean, where do libertarians draw the line? I'm assuming that you think that we should have, at the very least, paid police and fire departments?
Yeah, no, you want paid police and fire departments? I might even
paid
be for public education, because education is important. But what we need to do with public education is something like what they did in D.C. and the left tried to shut down. And that's give students vouchers so that they could actually move from the failing schools into the productive schools. And, you know, of course, President Obama, when he was in, opposed that. And it's something that Speaker Boehner stood up for. It was one of the few votes that he took. And the D.C., the demand within D.C. parents.
Well, the problem with that example, Charles, and you and I both lived in D.C. I lived in D.C. You live there now. So, you know, we're familiar with this. The problem with that, it was the two different issues got mixed up in that debate. And the main Democratic opposition was not to figuring out a way that kids can choose which school they want to go to. It was that one of the choices was taxpayer-subsidized religious and for-profit schools. That was the objection.
I
support that objection.
As much as you want. You can equivocate as much as you want. The point is that the left stood against student choice in that. Students wanted to go to better schools. And you can take out one of the choices, but the fact is that they were able to move around the district and go to well-performing schools.
It sounds like you're still arguing in favor of fully subsidized, at least primary education. And if that's the case, how can you call yourself a libertarian? I mean, David Koch ran for vice president in 1980 on a campaign of ending all public education. He said that the state schools simply indoctrinate students to be, good citizens of the state, rather than good libertarians.
I didn't advocate for it. I said it's a possibility. The fact is if we can give students vouchers where they can vote, we've at least added free market policies to the thing.
But why would you do that to the commons? What free market policy are you going to bring to the fire department?
I know that you want to give all the power to the teachers unions because that's the biggest voting block that you have left.
You can shout unions all day long. This is not about unions. It is. Unions are democracies in the workplace. Teachers, just like any other worker, should have the right to stand up to their employer if they feel that their working conditions are inappropriate, and they should have the right to collectively bargain their compensation. The fact that their employer is we the people, is the government, doesn't mean that there aren't bad bureaucrats who are total pains in the butt that individual teachers should have the power of a union behind them to go up against. But let's not make this a debate whether teachers' unions should exist, Charles.
This is the point, Tom. You're saying that the commons doesn't matter when it comes to defending the rights of the teachers. You're making that point. What I'm saying is that the teachers' rights
matter.
No,
I'm saying the teachers are employees.
They can't be separated.
Teachers are employees.
When it comes to the teacher.
Teachers are employees. And as employees, they should have the rights that employees should have in this country to collectively bargain. But that's a whole separate debate, which I'm pleased to have with you, and I think we just did, from whether we should have debt-free education and everybody should be able to go to school and learn to the maximum of their intellectual capability without incurring any debt and without having substantial expenses. And I don't see any libertarian way to accomplish that. Your school voucher example from D.C. was still federal money in the case of D.C., or it would have been state money if it was local or county money, was still taxpayer money. Where is the libertarian argument outside of David Koch's argument that, there simply shouldn't be any public education, the rich should be able to go to school, and everybody else, tough luck, Charlie? I mean, isn't that the official libertarian position?
Look, I know that, you want to, when you obscure the funding, because school is not debt-free. Look, you can go to any website that says the debt ticker. I think it's debtticker.com and see the debt actually raising. So what I want to do is actually put free market controls on that where people are deciding where the best value is. And when you remove that and let unions control it, despite what the commons need, which is good education. Again, you and I agree that education is what society needs. Where we disagree is on the best way to do it. And I know that you want to side with the workers and teachers over the kids, but I want to support my future kids' debt, and that is by reducing spending now. And we do that through competition, Tom.
So you have not yet answered my question, Charles.
I'll answer it.
How do libertarians recommend that everybody in America be able to get educated regardless of their economic status? How do you do that? How is a kid in a poor neighborhood, whether it's Detroit or Appalachia, how does a kid from a poor neighborhood or from a poor family whose parents can't afford private school, how do they get a decent education if public schools are defunded the way you're suggesting, or even if they have the choice between two or three local public, and by the way, in large swaths of America, there's you got small towns that have one school.
Yeah, that's true. But you just wipe that out when you don't want to let kids possibly move around and vote with their feet. And that's the reason people are willing to stay in that bad school, because if they move to another district, they might be stuck with that bad school.
So you don't have a way to fund this, bottom line.
No, the fact that you can't move from where we're at, which is a fully funded public education system, to not funding it. We need a bridge. And what I'm talking about is the bridge. And this is something the left should use more often. They should follow the profit motives of the market, and they should figure out how to give the best public education they can. And right now they're not. They're just empowering teachers to abuse our kids and put us in more debt.
Okay, Charles, I'll leave you with the last word. Charles Sauer, libertarian economist and president of the Market Institute. Marketinstitute.org is the website. Has a new book coming out, if you're inclined. Profit Motive, What Drives the Things We Do. You can tweet him at Charles Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. Charles, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of the news of the day and your calls here on the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. I had a, here it is right here. Susie, watching Free Speech TV in Eureka, Montana. Before you go on, Susie, I just wanted to, in my pitch for people to support Free Speech TV, which runs at the top and bottom of the hours, I neglected to mention, and my apologies, Mike W. from San Francisco, who made a $5,000 contribution yesterday to Free Speech TV. Mike, thank you so much. And, you know, keep up the great work. But tip of the hat, and I'm looking forward to seeing you, Mike, at one of our we were calling them pizza parties, but now we're going to a restaurant. So whatever you call it, our lunches. Susie, what's on your mind today?
Well, thank you for what you've done, Tom. One of the reasons I can keep a real positive focus is listening to your program and Free Speech TV. I'm on Social Security, and I've managed to renew my membership. And I'm going to challenge other people in tight financial circumstances to do the same thing.
Thank you.
We've got to support your voice and Professor Wolf's and so many other of the truth.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Susie. Yeah, only one out of 50 people who watch Free Speech TV pick up the phone and call and become members. And I know, you know, some of our nonprofit stations are carrying this as well. You know, KBCS and others, nonprofit stations all across the country, they similarly have pledge drives that may be running even right now. And you know, it's probably about the same. It's probably about 2% of their listeners call in. And so let's all encourage people, you know, in this case, it's the Free Speech TV Fund Drive, but if it's your local, if you're listening to a local radio station, community-supported radio station, support them too. Susie, thank you so much for the comments.
Yes, sir. And I wanted to let you know, you have activated me along with our revolution, and I'm signed up, and I'll be on the June ballot for precinct committee person.
Really?
So thank you for that.
So yes. How did you do that? Did you just show up at your local Democratic Party?
No, I was contacted because I keep bothering people and leaving messages at our revolution numbers. Mm-hmm. And I've been on their mailing list. So I was asked if I would consider becoming a precinct committee person.
Whoa.
And I
go ahead, continue.
Didn't really expect that I would have to run on a ballot because they said usually, you know, no one shows up and people just get, you know, told,
right,
oh, you can be the precinct committee person because you're part of the power structure.
Right.
Anyway, I'm going to try and do my part. I'm working with our superintendent of schools. They have a bond election on the same ballot. So off we go.
Yeah.
Good luck.
That's marvelous,
and
Susie.
I know you have other listeners up in this area of Montana. The progressives are kind of spread out.
Mm-hmm.
But please, let's all work together and work for education for our kids. I'm so glad that's been kind of the theme of the day.
Yeah.
So proud of those high school kids.
And if you're near Eureka, Montana, and you're a Democrat, vote for Susie for precinct committee person. Susie, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to hear from you. Thank you so much. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's coming up on 21 minutes past the hour. Exposing the con and conservative, Tom Hartman here with you. Rick in Beloit, Wisconsin. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to put a platform out there and just use your show as a megaphone for how to empower some of these students that are in this protest.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be by making sure part of their movement is to make sure that every student, when they reach the age of 18, immediately registers to vote, because that's where the real power is going to be in pushing political leaders.
Yep, and I think these kids are getting it, too. I think they're figuring that out, just like my generation figured that out during the Vietnam War, and we actually got a constitutional amendment passed allowing 18-year-olds to vote. And it was a big deal. And, yeah.
Well, this can be a big wake-up call to enact that type of movement and that type of activity. And I think that'll speak loudly as well, just that oncoming mass of voters moving to the polls.
There you go. Rick, thank you. Well said. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM. Also on SiriusXM, John in Santa Ana, California. Hey, John, your daughter organized a walkout?
Yeah, at her school. And I just wanted to compliment her school. I've heard some of the people talking about how either the school merely tolerated a walkout or others actually put kids on detention. At her school, she told them in advance, and they arranged an active shooter drill for earlier this morning. And then at 10 o'clock, they finished the active shooter drill and said anybody that wanted to stay around and listen to my daughter give a little speech on gun violence could, and everybody else go back to class. So I really appreciated this school's accommodation.
That is great. That is great. That sounds like a good school. I understand. I haven't confirmed this yet. I haven't had an opportunity to read much news since we went on the air at 9 o'clock Pacific time. But I understand that in Texas, there are schools that are actually suspending and kicking kids out of school for walking out today.
Right.
Have you heard that?
That's what I've heard as well.
Yeah. That's real unfortunate. That's real unfortunate. Well, congratulations, John, and good on your daughter. Tell her we all applaud her. We all think it's great.
Will do. Talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks a lot. Peach in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Peach, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Oh, my gosh. I'm on the phone with Tom Hartman. I listen to you every day.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to say I'm really happy about Pennsylvania. I'm really glad to see the growing momentum. My question to the DNC guy that you had on had to do with their current initiative about We Will Vote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is he saying for anybody, really? I mean,
what do you mean?
I've been working in food and beverage and retail all my life. My coworkers are people working two jobs, trying to get over. They don't understand politics very deeply, a lot of them, and they're very disengaged. A lot of them don't vote.
Right.
They're waiting for a representative candidate. You know, asking people to sign up to vote for anybody they trot out is not going to engage these people. I'm just telling you.
I understand, Peach, but here's the process.
So I'm wondering whether the DNC has really learned that a large number of non-voters are waiting for a representative candidate. I know we're up against fascism here. I understand that. And it sounds really tempting, but I don't think it's going to mobilize the non-voters I know.
Okay. Here's what research shows, that when people register to vote and actually vote, they're far more likely to engage with the information necessary to be a well-educated voter. In other words, they start to pay attention. Just like when you drive a car, suddenly you're paying attention to all the traffic. It's you know, when you become a voter, you start paying attention to politics. And so registering people to vote, even your friends who are apolitical, who, you know, get their news from the National Enquirer. Go ahead.
I'm listening and I hear that. A lot of these folks are registered. What they are is principled non-voters. They have decided that neither party is putting out a candidate that is going to represent them. And what I'm seeing, just watching, because I'm very, you know, engaged online and stuff, I'm seeing the DNC trotting out Biden and Kennedy, who are both 1% are white men, and it seems to me kind of like a dog whistle to their donor class. And I'm wondering why, you know, they aren't trying to find somebody that's going to mobilize and excite their actual base.
Well, the DNC has not, I mean, they chose Kennedy to, Joe Kennedy III, to give the rebuttal to the State of the Union address. I thought it was a mistake. I thought he did an unfortunate job. But Joe Biden, he was the vice president. He's past his prime. His time has come and gone. I mean, if he were to run for president, if Joe Biden were to run for president, and I know he's talking about it, and I know that there's a chance he'll throw his hat in the ring for the primary, and there's probably a lot of people who go, oh, he was with Obama for 8 years. Yeah, we should vote for him. He was the principal author of the bankruptcy bill that made it illegal for young people to discharge student debt.
I totally agree.
I mean, you know, he's a good guy in a lot of regards, but not in all.
I'm seeing these guys as dog whistles to the donor class from the DNC. I think the DNC uses dog whistle politics in a different way than the GOP. But
I'm not hearing the DNC.
I want to see a black woman at the top of the ticket.
Well, that, in all probability, that would be Kamala Harris. And I think that she's a potentially a really, really serious contender. Peach, thank you for the call. It's an interesting conversation. I really appreciate it. And thank you for your kind words. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's coming up on 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And we're going to check in with Dr. Trita Parsi about what's going on with the whole Iran thing right after this. The Trump crime family freak show rolls on. Trump goes down to Texas to look at these wall prototypes. And one of the guys who bid on the gig was bombed a mosque. It's like it doesn't get weirder than this. You've got Rex Tillerson out. And Mike Pompeo in. There's a lot of theories about exactly why that is. I think it's because Mike Pompeo knows how to suck up to billionaires. I think that that's the new skill set necessary in American politics. And, you know, if you suck up well to the Koch brothers, you have a really good career. Pompeo was a business, you know, did business with them first, and then he became, you know, their boy in Congress. And now he's Trump's lickspittle or whatever the word is that hopefully doesn't have any kind of racial intent or overtones or whatever, just, you know, is toady, I guess, is the word to use. Whew, amazing. We talked about opioids and, oh, Trita Parsi, I'm sorry. Yeah, everybody thought I was building up to putting Trita on, and I'm very sorry. Dr. Trita Parsi is here with us, with NIAC, the National Iranian American Council. NIACCouncil.org is the website. And Dr. Parsi, welcome back to the program, and my apologies.
No worries. How are you?
I'm fine. My ADD got me. I got totally derailed about a minute before we went on the air. That doesn't happen very often, but my most sincere apologies. I am concerned, and I wanted to get you on about this. I am very, very concerned about this whole deal with Mike Pompeo and Iran. There's the obvious argument being made that how can you try to convince North Korea that they should cut a no more nukes deal with us when we're ready to blow up our no more nukes deal with Iraq, or with Iran, rather, excuse me. But beyond that, Pompeo and Trump seem to me like they're hell-bent for leather to have a war with Iran, which I think, frankly, could start World War III. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I do believe that a vote for Pompeo in the Senate is essentially a vote for the United States to initiate and lead a regional war in the Middle East. This is a person who's been very clear. He tweeted right the day before he was announced as the pick for the CIA directorship position, that he looks forward to rolling back the Iran nuclear deal. He's consistently taking a position in favor of regime change. All of the neoconservative positions that got us into the previous war. And you mentioned earlier on that, you know, why would you do that if you want to strike a deal with North Korea? Well, that's logical. The problem is that the current president seems to be abiding by a completely different logic. I think it is more likely that he will think, mindful of his mindset, that he will signal his willingness to walk away from the deal from the North Koreans unless they give him what he wants by being able to show them, look, I actually killed the Iran deal. So don't for a second think that I'm not willing to walk away from a negotiation with you.
So that would be consistent with his art of the deal strategies, I guess.
Exactly. Mindful of his way of dealing with things, I actually think that there's a high likelihood that he will kill the Iran deal because he will think it will strengthen his hand with the North Korea.
Well, and here's where that's really problematic. If you're a real estate developer and you're negotiating with a town for a tax abatement, or you're negotiating with a concrete supplier, being willing to walk away from the deal is, you know, generally a fairly important part of the negotiating process. But if you're a country and you walk away from a deal, you could, you could inflame the world. It could lead to war.
Exactly. And that's why having someone who knows nothing but real estate is not a good fit for someone who's supposed to be operating in a completely different world, in which walking away is not necessarily a good option, because as you said, it can inflate an entire world, and you can't deal with countries as if they're your subcontractors. They're not.
Right. Exactly. So what do we do about this? We're talking with Dr. Trita Parsi, the president of the National Iranian American Council. NIACcouncil.org is the website, and you can tweet him at tparsi, P-A-R-S-I. What should we be doing? I mean, if I wanted to call Congress at 202-225-3121, and which is the main switchboard for Congress, and ask for one of my two senators or my member of the House of Representatives, what would I say? Or is that even the path that we should be following to be activist about this?
I do believe that it is a path that we have to follow right now, because if a scenario can be prevented in which Trump is completely surrounded by neoconservatives and warmongers, and that is a much better way of preventing war than any other pathway that exists right now, and Pompeo can fail in the Senate, there are opposition to him on both sides of the aisle, and that's the most effective way of preventing war right now. Otherwise, my fear is that there will be a war, and then the next option is to actually stop that war that already has started rather than actually preventing it.
What is the state of affairs and relations right now between the United States and Iran, and how is Iran doing in the world at large, as a country? I mean, where are they at?
Well, the Iranians are in a tight position right now. Their economy is not doing well. There's a lot of disappointment with the nuclear deal. They were really expecting it to become much more, bringing in a much better economic situation for them. And Trump is partly to blame because he's actively been sabotaging the nuclear deal and scaring away businesses. So that's definitely contributed to their economic problems, though most of it is actually self-inflicted, but nevertheless. But this has pushed them increasingly in the direction of other countries like Russia and China. So this is going to be a major problem. And I think for them, the nuclear deal was a test case for two schools of thought in Iran. One that said, look, the problem with the West can be resolved. If Iran shows flexibility and compromises, there can be an acceptance and the issue can be resolved. Another school that said, no, the West and regional allies of the West have an inherent problem with Iran. They would never like to see it coming out of the chains of sanctions and isolation. And it doesn't matter what the Iranians do. That is an unchanging position of the West. Well, now we have a test case. We had a deal. And Iran has lived up to the deal. Iran agreed to major compromises. And yet, in spite of all that, if the deal is killed by the United States and its allies, the school of thought that thinks that, see, the West is inherently against Iran, even when we compromise, it didn't make a difference, that school is likely going to prevail. And the result is going to be that the Iranians are going to be pursuing a much, much harsher policy in the region, because they're going to reach the conclusion that they can never get acceptance unless they force the other side to accept them, not by compromise, but by coercion.
To what extent is the realignment of Israel with Saudi Arabia, with the Sunni Muslim world, essentially, and to some extent, I'd say, it appears to me anyway, and you know this stuff better than I, so please reality check me on it, that even the Trump administration seems to be aligning itself with the Sunni world and in opposition to the Shia world, at least as much as Iran is one of the major Shia countries in the world. What's going on with that, and what are your thoughts on that, and to what extent is that Israeli-Saudi alliance is not the right word, but How does that influence all this?
Well, I wouldn't divide it as a Sunni-Shia thing, because I think it's more about the countries who want the United States to come into the region as a hegemon and support them and give them their the maneuverability that they enjoyed in the 1990s. So you have an alliance between Wahhabi Saudi Arabia and Zionist Israel right now. There's no way to explain that through ideological explanations. That can only be explained from the perspective of the balance of power. And that simultaneously, Wahhabi Saudi Arabia is imposing a blockade, and there's a risk of war between Wahhabi Saudi Arabia and Wahhabi Qatar, because that's the only other Wahhabi country in the world. So I think this is much more to do with the balance of power, in which Saudi Arabia and Israel want the United States to be a very strong military presence in the region. They would be the pillars, the local pillars of that order, and it would be based on the United States paying the cost of isolating, containing countries such as Iran, Iraq, any others who are questioning American hegemony in the region.
Remarkable. Anything you'd like to add to this?
I'll just go back to what we talked about earlier on, which I think, you know, there is a there definitely is a chance for Pompeo not to be approved in the Senate, and that would be one major blow against those who are hoping to drag the United States into a regional war.
And a positive step if we can prevent Pompeo from being approved by the Senate. The number for Congress is 202-225-3121. Dr. Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, NIACCouncil.org is the website. You can tweet him at tparsi or at NIAC Council, or at NIA Council. Dr. Parsi, thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
It's always great. Always great talking with you. It's always informative. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. And welcome back. Tiger in Culver City, California. Hey, Tiger, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to make a comment about the debate that goes on regarding charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's far more nuanced than... It's always black and white, and that's exemplified by the fellow's comment that competition creates quality. The thing of it is, children aren't commodities. They're beings that have different needs, and there's a whole variety of child development theories and curriculums, art-based curriculums, and all kinds of things. And what's happening is... which was why the charter movement was so exciting when it started, before it was co-opted by for-profits, was that it was going to explore different ways of educating children.
I remember.
And parents would have had choices. This way you wouldn't have had to try to... but, for example, there's a charter school nearby who has excellent, excellent results. They're arts-based, and a lot of parents want to get into that charter school. However, part of the paradigm requires that the parents be on board in a particular kind of way in their home life and how things are approached regarding whether or not there's homework or that kind of thing. And very often people come, they just want the results. You know, they want the results, but they don't want to do what the curriculum or the child development theory is asking of them. And so it gets very, very tense. I just want to offer that I think the dialogue needs to be far more nuanced. I mean, you could crush a really good thing. I think charter schools are very good, but it's the for-profit that creates the problem, and maybe that needs to be what has changed.
And I would add, not just the for-profit, but also the religious schools. You've got now Scientology starting their own charter schools.
Correct.
You've got, you know, the Catholics, of course, for a long, long time have been big in education. These are not appropriately public schools. These are private schools, and they should have been called private schools all along. I remember when in the early days of the charter school movement, I mean, this is like back in the 80s, as I recall.
Right.
In fact, one of the people who was the program director of our Community for Abused Kids in New Hampshire back in the late 70s, early 80s, went on to start a charter school in California. It did very well. And at that point in time, the charter schools were basically local public schools that were deciding to focus on things that where they would relatively specialize, arts and entertainment, for example, or science and math, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, that makes a certain amount of sense. And, you know, I don't disagree with that. Yeah, but the forces that have been that whole movement was swept up in, you know, like the currents in a river, the ones that I mentioned, the money, the religion, but then the third one is race. You've got, you know, I mean, the state of Virginia, after the Brown versus Board of Education decision that schools had to be integrated, literally closed all their public schools for an entire year, because the state of Virginia refused to have. I believe it was Virginia. It might have been Maryland, but I'm pretty sure it was Virginia. Refused mm-hmm. to have, you know, use state money to pay for the education of integrated school for black kids in integrated schools. And so there's all these different cross currents, these different competing interests, and just keeping our eye on the notion of public schools, publicly funded schools. And yes, experimentation is good. It, you know, yes, I'm with you. Tiger, thank you for the call. I got to run. But thank you very much. Great to hear from you. And thank you for watching us on YouTube. We'll be back. It's coming up on 11 minutes before the hour. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Tom. Thanks for picking me up.
Sure.
When you were talking to Charles Soros, sweet guy, but I think misled, he kept talking about how charter schools and vouchers are the answer to lower-level education. But never does anyone seem to remember that part of Senator Sanders' platform was to put like a 1% tax on the purchase of stock. That just seems to have disappeared from our consciousness. But every day, everything we touch is taxed. The only thing purchased in this country that is never taxed is stock. And if that tax had, if he had won, we would now see a tax on stock that would fund college educations for every child.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. On every stock trade, yes.
Yes.
And it was a quarter of 1%, as I recall, is what he was calling for. I mean, we had this law from World War I until the 1960s. I think 65 was the year that we took it down. We had this excise tax, STET tax, they called it, Securities Transaction Excise Tax, I think is what STET stood for. And, you know, it was, I think it might have even been a half a percent. But it raised so much money when they killed it off in the 60s. They killed it off because it was supposed to pay for the Securities and Exchange Commission, one of the reasons why it was put in place in the first place. And, you know, it was generating so much extra money that I guess the Republicans said, we don't need this. But, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And that would be a great way to do it. Norma, thank you for the call. And thanks for reminding me of that. That's a good one. Carlene in Jersey City, New Jersey. Am I saying your name right?
You are, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Yeah, it's my pleasure, and thanks for taking my call. You know, Tom, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, the forgotten American. And whenever we think about the forgotten American, we're thinking of people, you know, that are the underserved. And I'm a single 56-year-old woman. I do not own property. I don't have children. When I get my paycheck every week, a third of my paycheck is taken out in taxes. So when I see news reports of our politicians like Ryan Zinke or Ben Carson or Kellyanne Conway or even Donald Trump spending $130 million in taxes to fly to Mar-a-Lago using our money, I get really infuriated.
Especially since they're all rich.
They're all rich. And, you know, I make a good salary, don't get me wrong, but after taxes, I might as well be making nothing, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have been thinking about this a lot, and I wanted to ask you if you know of a case or have ever heard of a case where there's been a class action. I know this is going to sound crazy, but I've been thinking about it a lot, like a class action lawsuit against the government for misusing the people's money. It is our money. It is our government. They work for us.
Right.
And I don't mind, as a single person who has no children, paying for schools, paying for infrastructure, paying for things that will make this company great. I cried the day that he was put into office because I knew things were just going to spiral down. But now I'm just angry. I'm angry about what they're getting away with. and how they're profiting in the White House. So I don't know if there's ever been any kind of cases, any kind of civil lawsuits or anything like that. But, you know, it's coming around tax time, and I completely do not want to pay my taxes.
Yeah, I get what you're saying and empathize totally, Carlene. There's this thing called sovereign immunity. You can't sue the government. However, there is a mechanism for reacting to these kinds of abuses, and it's called the election. And mm-hmm. I think that what we saw in Pennsylvania yesterday, where you had a district that went 21 points for Trump, it went more than 20 points for Mitt Romney. For two out of the last four or five elections, the Democratic Party didn't even bother putting a candidate up in that district. And Connor Lamb won. And I don't think it's just because people think that Trump is evil or they're horrified by Stormy Daniels or they think he's in the bag with Putin or whatever it may be. I think it's that they're sick and tired of the whole damn Republican Party behaving mm-hmm. like a RICO organization and, you know, being only interested in the interests of the billionaires, the corporations, and themselves. And I think the outrage that you are expressing, Carlene, is broadly shared across the United States, regardless of party. And, it's a good thing that people are waking up. And what we need to do is we can't translate it into a lawsuit. I understand your sentiment, but we can translate it into action at the polling places. So the step
right.
to do.
And I do my good share, not to interrupt you, but I do my good share of activism, and I'm very involved. I'm also, a gay American. I'm a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And so when I see the rollbacks in civil rights, not just for gay and lesbian people, but just in civil rights in general and the EPA and everything, I mean, it just adds more salt to the wound.
Yeah. I absolutely understand, and I'm totally with you. Carlene, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Robert in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to you quite a bit, and I've learned an awful lot, and you touched on many, many points of the complex issues that we have, and I doubt I can get it all in, but I'd like to send you an email to itemize it and get some kind of acknowledgement that you heard me. But let me just jump into it a little bit. You've talked about the billionaires' lack of empathy. There's a very clear reason for that, and that is because they have lived sheltered lives, most of them, and they have never experienced struggle and pain that we little people experience. We're communal by nature, and we rely on everybody around us. The billionaires, they strictly extract the benefits and put nothing into it. They don't see a need to. They use our tax money. They use our court systems, our politicians, our law enforcement to protect their wealth. They preach to us to invest in the stock market, saying we should not be owning our homes. We need to use other people's money and invest. And it's like the definition of insanity, Einstein's definition. We little people, we're the other people. They're using our money. When we have our life savings invested in there, they yank the rug out from under us, and then we come right back and put our money in there again. I think that they are just taking and taking, and
I think we need to separate these issues, Robert. Home ownership and participation in the stock markets are ways that people build wealth. Home ownership, in particular, is how most middle-class wealth in the United States has been built. That said, you're right. You know, we're being constantly scammed and conned by the morbidly rich, and you know we need to do something about it. And I think that, frankly, we are. As I said to the caller before that, you know, it's at the ballot box. It's get out there, get active, you know, tag your it, get politically active. I mean, that's what we have to do. Our earlier caller who said that she's going to become a precinct committee person. It's like, that is so cool. I mean, you know, having real power. And you can just walk in and volunteer in most places and yes, please. So anyhow, we'll see you tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.